she just looked at me very intently and squeezed my hand and said, "I don't get bought off."
An Alaskan appeals to Senator Murkowski to vote no on the latest health care bill. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, as electric cars become more popular, will Alaska's oil economy suffer?
Does it keep me up at night? Not too often, but it's not just a thought experiment by any means.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
ExxonMobil Alaska. Their financial investment and partnership with local companies at Point Thompson helps contribute to Alaska's economy and jobs for Alaskans. ExxonMobil, energy lives here.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Proponents of repealing the Affordable Care Act revealed yet another new draft of the bill today. The sponsors have made changes that appear designed to win the vote of Senator Lisa Murkowski, one of three Republicans who killed the last repeal bill. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
The latest version of the Graham-Cassidy bill, like the original, would provide block grants to the states in place of federal spending on insurance subsidies and expanded Medicaid. As in the original, the block grants in the revised bill would mean a cut in funding for Alaska compared to what the state gets under current law. But the new proposal does not cut as deeply as the original Graham-Cassidy bill.
There is a lot of special treatment for Alaska.
Timothy Jost is a professor emeritus at Washington and Lee University School of Law. He reviewed the current bill draft for the Health Affairs blog. Jost says the revision is peppered with money for states that have low population density, higher poverty lines, and other descriptors that apply to Alaska and only a few other states.
It just basically gives Alaska more money.
But according to a fact sheet that's circulating with the proposal, Alaska would still lose $99 million over 7 years when you compare the block grants to the federal funding in existing law. That's about a tenth of what Alaska would lose under the original Graham-Cassidy bill. The bill also makes big changes to the traditional Medicaid program. Bill sponsor Senator Lindsey Graham said at a hearing on the bill that government revenues just can't keep pace with health care spending.
Most of you know that by 2042 that the entire revenue stream will be consumed by Medicare and Medicaid spending unless somebody does something about it.
Graham's bill, though, would increase spending for non-expansion Medicaid in Alaska. The new version increases the federal matching rate for Alaska and Hawaii. It's not clear how much money that would bring to Alaska. It's possible it could more than make up for revenue losses elsewhere in the bill. But there's more than money at stake. The new version would also allow states to more easily drop insurance standards in the Affordable Care Act. States would be allowed to undermine protection for people with pre-existing conditions. That has people like Todd Brown of Anchorage concerned. He says he ran into Senator Murkowski at the farmers market in South Anchorage on Saturday. About 30 people were waiting to talk to her. Some, like him, wanted to talk about the repeal bill.
I said, you know, Lisa, I know that there's going to be a lot of pressure and a lot of powerful people who are most likely going to offer you, large packages of money and try to trade favors, but I hope that you don't allow them to buy you off.
Brown says Murkowski reassured him.
She just looked at me very intently and squeezed my hand and said, "I don't get bought off."
Senator Dan Sullivan says he's undecided, too. And it's not clear either of them will have to take a position. At least three Republicans have now announced they will vote no. If that holds, it would be enough to kill the bill. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company is investigating how crude oil ended up in the port of Valdez after a spill last Thursday. Since cleanup efforts began, Alyeska estimates about 400 gallons of oily water have been recovered. Alyeska says the spill happened during yearly testing of the pipes that deliver crude oil to tankers. During an unplanned pause in testing, oily water flowed back through the system, out of the intake pipe, and into the port of Valdez. There was containment boom in place during the testing, but the intake pipe was outside of the boom. Spokeswoman Kate Duggan says Alyeska has ruled out equipment failure, but isn't ready to pinpoint human error as the cause of the spill.
Maybe that's what the investigation's gonna determine.
The state has not yet confirmed the total amount of crude oil that ended up in the water. Jeff Merrill at the State Department of Environmental Conservation says the nature of the spill makes it hard to figure out.
This is not a traditional spill, and so estimating oil volume estimating is very difficult and is an inexact thing.
Merrill says the state is also investigating the root cause of the spill, but it hasn't come to any conclusions. Donna Shantz, executive director of the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council, says her group is generally happy with Alyeska's response to the incident, but Shantz says the amount of oil of work it's taking to recover from a relatively small spill should be a wake-up call.
We're fortunate that it wasn't a larger amount spilled, fortunate that the weather cooperated, but I think it really makes people realize the challenges that we'd be faced with had this been a larger spill.
Cleanup is continuing. Since the spill was first reported, more than 290 people, dozens of vessels, and just under 22,000 feet of boom have been deployed. Dozens of helicopter pilots and maintenance personnel from Alaska's Air National Guard are heading overseas to combat the Islamic State. The Guard announced this afternoon that 60 members of a rescue squadron under the 176th Wing are deploying to assist in Operation Inherent Resolve, the United States military campaign against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. The deployment will last 4 months, and airmen will be based in Southwest Asia, though a spokesman for the National Guard in Alaska declined to specify which country. Operation Inherent Resolve began in 2014. It involves units from the U.S. Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines who have conducted more than 17,000 airstrikes and been part of efforts to arm and assist allies on the ground. The guardsmen are pilots and support crew for Pave Hawk helicopters used in rescuing service members behind enemy lines. In Alaska, they regularly take part in search and rescue missions in remote and dangerous terrain. Guardsmen are set to deploy early tomorrow morning from Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an effort to recycle the massive fishing nets that pile up in Unalaska.
It seems so unreasonable and not logic to basically just throw it away.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
The REAA School Board election is October 3rd. Polls are open at 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. When you go vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the register, you may vote a question ballot. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Alaska's economy is powered by oil. So are the vast majority of cars and trucks worldwide. But globally, the market for electric vehicles is growing. So as more people move away from gasoline-powered cars, the big players in the oil industry have started to pay attention, and that includes Alaska. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
On a recent weekend, nearly 70 electric vehicles are lined up in a bare parking lot in downtown Juneau. It's the city's annual electric vehicle fair.
When you grab the door handle,
John Cooper is here showing off his two EVs. And he's proud to say he was one of Juneau's early adopters. He invites me inside his fully electric sedan and pops the keys in the ignition. Cooper says there are plenty of charging stations in Juneau. Range anxiety isn't an issue. The convenience of owning one was a big selling point.
when you're on your way to work, your car is full, and it's just it's an incredible feeling to get in the car, and you're sitting, like, the whole time that we've been talking, or most of the time that we've been talking, this car has been on and idling.
It's quiet because there's no rumble of the gasoline-powered internal combustion engine. Not that long ago, electric vehicles weren't commercially available. But over the span of about 5 years, the number of EVs has reached into the millions worldwide. That's still only a tiny fraction of cars on the road. Even so, oil companies and even estate economist Neil Fried are paying attention.
Does it keep me up at night? Not too often, but it's not just a thought experiment by any means.
For the past 40 years, Alaska has paid its bills largely using oil revenue. Recently, that's presented the economy with some extreme challenges. And Fried says electric cars are potentially yet another threat. How big of a threat? Well, that depends a lot on how quickly the shift happens.
Well, I mean, look at iPhones and how fast they are adopted. Would the same thing happen with cars? I don't know.
There's a range of opinions on that. Some energy analysts have forecasted that electric vehicles could outsell gasoline cars by 2040. Then there are companies like BP, which project much smaller numbers. In any case, Sam Ori agrees with Fried. He's the executive director at the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago. The global demand for oil is still increasing, but Ori says as consumers snap up more electric cars, the demand could start to flatten out.
It's not as if people are going to stop showing up to buy oil from Alaska, but the price at which they buy that oil is going to be less than it otherwise would have been because of this change in the oil market. Electric vehicles are a piece of that, a small piece, but they're a piece of that, and they're going to become a bigger piece of it.
He says electric vehicles and more fuel-efficient cars are already affecting the global oil market. That trend is likely to continue as countries consider measures to reduce carbon emissions. The Chinese government is thinking about banning gasoline-powered cars altogether. But Ori says a transition isn't going to happen overnight.
I think if people are thinking of it as like, well, are electric vehicles going to become so widespread in the next few years that they eliminate the demand for oil, and like we have all this oil and there's no one who's going to buy it? Yeah, that's not happening soon.
Still, Ori says globally it's becoming cheaper to produce oil. Far-flung places where it's expensive to drill, like Alaska, could start to look less and less appealing. Back at Juno's electric vehicle fair, Monique Reeder is taking a break from the rain underneath the tailgate tent. She's here promoting her dealership, which carries fully electric vehicles. But Reeder herself?
You know, I don't actually own a car, but I do take home demos.
In any case, she doesn't think the capital city's enthusiasm to move away from gasoline cars has to be a reflection on the state's economy. She says Alaska will have to adapt.
Because we don't want what's happening with the barrel prices. We don't want that to affect our economy so much where it's really hurting our budget because we are just dependent on one. If we can diversify, it's going to be a positive all around.
As for her business, Reeder's been selling electric cars for about a year. She says they've been flying off the lot. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, with help from Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
In America's top fishing port, there are a lot of old fishing nets piled up. There's no easy way to get rid of them in Unalaska. The community is remote, and nets can weigh thousands of pounds. Now, for the first time, about 80 retired nets are on their way to a recycling program halfway around the world. Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
The view outside Unalaska's Grand Aleutian Hotel is almost always the same. Men moving piles of fishing nets. Today is no exception. With the help of a crane, Andy Perillo is part of a team hoisting huge nets into the back of a flatbed truck. His job? Compressing the nets so they can fit tightly into shipping containers and be sent to Denmark. It's not easy.
You know, you're getting showered by rust, dirt, jellyfish, squid, you know, anything can fall off the back of the crane, so.
Perillo has been coming up to fish in Unalaska for 3 years. Today, he's happy to be helping clean up the island for the people who live here year-round. He has one person to thank for coordinating this project, Nicole Baker. In 2010, Baker started coming up to Unalaska as a fisheries observer, and the piles of nets caught her eye.
I just noticed that there was a lot of old junky nets lying around.
These nets are monstrous, from 5 to 20,000 pounds each. The industrial gear was used for catching pollock and cod. Finding a way to remove and repurpose the nets became Baker's passion project. For the past 2 years, she's been looking for organizations capable of recycling the worn-out gear. She sent samples to companies like Parley for the Oceans, who was working to make sneakers with Adidas out of nets confiscated from illegal fishing.
And so I wrote those guys an email, and I was like, if you're interested in, you know, unused fishing nets, I know where you could possibly get some.
The problem was they only wanted nylon nets, and most of the nets in Unalaska are made of polyethylene or polypropylene. So Baker kept looking. Eventually, she found the Global Ghost Gear Initiative, an organization focused on dealing with abandoned fishing gear, and they suggested a company capable of recycling the nets.
My name is Hans Axel Christensen. And I am the CEO of Plastix, and I am today 51 years old, and I am living in Copenhagen in Denmark.
Plastix is focused on recycling unwanted fishing gear into high-quality plastic pellets.
It seems so unreasonable and not logical to basically just throw it away when we know that if handling plastics right, if sorting and homogenizing it right, then you can actually reuse it over and over and over and over again.
According to Christensen, Plastix is the only company in the world recycling fishing nets in this way. Once the nets arrive at the plant, they're cut into smaller pieces, sorted by material type, be it polyethylene, nylon, or polypropylene, and processed.
You cannot produce a quality recyclate if you don't ensure that you get the right input. If you get a lot of crap, then you can produce crap recyclates.
For now, Plastix is selective about who they work with. The company is small, and they want to be sure they're only sent products they can recycle. If a container is loaded with unusable waste, it will just end up in a landfill in Denmark. Christensen was happy to work with Baker to recycle the nets from Unalaska.
We cannot do this alone. We need someone like Trident Fish Food, Nicole Baker, all kinds of stakeholders to take part in this process.
This is the first time the company has recycled nets from the United States, and it involves buy-in from multiple parties. The captains or fishing companies are responsible for packing the nets small enough to fit into shipping containers. With the help of Trident Seafoods, Plastix is paying for the containers to be shipped directly to Denmark. This is the first year of the collaboration, but Baker says there was high demand from fishermen looking to find a new use for their nets.
I hope to keep this going somehow, so we'll see.
Continuing this recycling project will take more than just Baker. It will require investments and buy-in from multiple organizations, from the fishermen to Plastix. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
Being a teacher can be a tough and often thankless job, but the State Education Department celebrates the profession each year by naming a Teacher of the Year. The winner will be selected next month from a group of four finalists. This week, we're bringing their voices to the air. Today, it's Anchorage teacher Ben Walker, who teaches 7th grade science at Romig Middle School. Walker says teachers have very different challenges today than in past decades.
We have a number of students who are speaking English as a second language. We have a number of students who
you know, have some struggles that maybe didn't necessarily exist or weren't identified 20 to 30 years ago. So that's a really big challenge to kind of address those. The main thing, though, is to, you know, when you focus on the student instead of the teaching, then you can really start to address those rather than worrying about yourself and, well, I learned it this way, so everybody should be able to learn it this way. And a lot of that takes giving up control and allowing your students to kind of teach you how they learn best and then using your expertise to further that.
Seems like it would inspire a lot more creativity.
It inspires creativity on both ends when you give students the ability to kind of, you know, help shape their own learning. It's not like, you know, in the 70s there was these free school ideas where kids just kind of came and could do whatever they want. That's not really what it is, you know. It's more of a here's kind of our goal, whether it's content or skills. You know, what are some ways that we can get there that work for you? So you're still ending up in the same place.
Technology has transformed education. It's transformed everything. But it can also be an enormous distraction. How much of a challenge is the distraction of online media versus the benefit of it for you in the classroom?
You know, it really depends. You know, I think there's certainly a portion of our students who are overdoing that. But at the same time, you know, if a student or anybody is really interested in what they're doing, they have the, you know, they will not keep going to that as a distraction. I teach science, so coming from a scientific perspective, technology is awesome. Because, you know, if we were just going to rely on textbooks, you know, we'd be so far behind what science is actually doing. So we really try to embrace that.
One of the things that you said was students today must be able to learn, unlearn, and relearn to remain competitive in the workplace. What do you mean by that?
You know, it's no longer that students are going to have one or two careers in their life, you know. I mean, when we talk about the shift to kind of the gig economy, it's called, where people are more doing more, you know, shorter terms at different places. You need to be able to undo what you did, you know, keeping what's good about it and relearn something entirely different outside of your wheelhouse. And I think part of that is giving the students the ability to you know, be in charge of their own learning.
How do you go about helping your students understand the relevance of what they're looking at that maybe they can't immediately connect to, but is crucial for them to move forward and really have that full picture?
I spend a lot of time tying careers into what we do. So just showing them that what you do here in seventh grade, when you start on this path, you're picking up these skills, these ways of thinking. And the other thing is that, you know, if we want a community that's actually going to be a real viable community, it needs to be STEM literate. It needs to understand science, technology, and engineering, especially in Alaska. You know, when you pick up the paper or you go to the grocery store or you know, go to vote, it's nice to have a baseline of STEM literacy so you know, you look at some of the things that come up in our state with our resources or our fisheries. You know, if people want to have a valid, you know, input in that conversation, it helps if they at least have a basic understanding of what kind of things people are talking about. Otherwise, it's going to be only people that have those understandings that are going to make these decisions.
Ben Walker is one of four finalists to be Alaska's next Teacher of the Year. Tomorrow, we'll hear from Skagway High School English and History teacher Kent Fielding. More information is at our website, alaskapublic.org. Many former inmates say that to succeed after prison, they had to change their attitudes and think about life differently. But how do you do that when you're behind bars? Ann Hillman with Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk found out.
Ray Soto Lopez says when he was convicted of second-degree murder in 2001, he was thrown into a correctional system that focused entirely on punishment, not helping people succeed after prison. He says even just waking up wearing a yellow jumpsuit told him that he would always be a criminal, no matter what.
Control and punishment, at least for me, has never changed my attitude. It has managed my attitude, but it never really changed my internal perspective and attitude.
But Soto Lopez says he knew he didn't want to leave prison as the same person who entered. his old way of thinking wouldn't solve any of his problems.
I didn't want to commit another crime. I wanted to figure out why I was so rebellious, so angry, so resentful. I wanted to realize and understand my addiction, my criminal mentality. I wanted to just figure out what was going on with me.
But how do you do that in prison when everything seems to say you can't change? Soto Lopez found those few people who told him something different.
It was that one chaplain that would come by when I felt bitter and angry and I was resentful and acting out, and would show me love when I least deserved it, when I least merited it, was there to stand by me, to believe in me no matter what, to say, hey, man, I believe that something good can come out of you.
With that support, he started a decade-long process of taking classes like anger management, parenting, and understanding victim impact. Classes focused on behavior and attitude are offered at most correctional centers in the state, but they aren't mandatory. Research shows the classes can be effective and change how people think, and they reduce recidivism by about 25% if they're taught by well-trained teachers. The most effective programs focus on anger management and problem solving. But Monica Hinders, who manages the education programs at Spring Creek Correctional Center in Seward, says inmates don't always sign up for them with the intent to change.
Some just enroll just because they know they look better on paper, and so they're trying to prepare for parole board or just to get a furlough to get out of here.
She says despite that, even just the basic social skills a person learns in a classroom, like listening and speaking respectfully during structured conversations, can make a positive difference. Participants have to analyze real-world situations together and reflect on how they would react and why. Some classes, like ones on parenting, also focus on improving the participants' ideas of self-worth.
You could have the teacher up there, Nana, you know, to say, and it's really not super beneficial, but that interaction with other inmates and having the trust in each other to be honest and open and hearing the other views and that kind of thing. That is, in here, if these guys are able to sit in a classroom and, you know, get along and not fight and not do what they sometimes like to do, that's a win.
And for some people, like Soto Lopez, those small wins add up. Using the social skills and self-analysis tools he learned in different types of programs, he was eventually able to take vocational classes too. Now, he's been out of prison for 3 months, lives in a halfway house, and is holding down a job with the Iron Workers Union in Anchorage. Soto Lopez practices his new skills in a welding booth at the union's office, melting a thin metal rod against two plates to attach them together.
If you don't do it right the first time, you got to redo the whole thing all over. So that's why you practice over and over before you take the test, because you only get one shot at the test.
He knows that now, because he sees the world differently, he's getting a second shot at life on the outside. From the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Do you have ideas for the Solutions Desk? Visit alaskapublic.org/solutions or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or NPR One. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Harbaugh, Zachariah Hughes, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Zoe Sobel in Onalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.